So I'll just very quickly say that you are a professor of philosophy and director of the MA program in the Philosophical Foundations of Physics at Columbia University. Also has two books, Quantum Mechanics and Experience of Time and Chance, and also an appearance in What the Bleep, which you disavow. Or
well, it happened.
it happened, but they disavow it.
Okay, so I'm the other of the two disreputable characters that Stuart Kaufman kept mentioning.
Well, you're the second of the three.
and this is another talk like Sean's, which is going to express a kind of megalomania on behalf of physics. Let me just put it in context. Stuart did something I think really helpful for our discussions here. As far as I can recall today, he's the first one who introduced a theme that's been very important in discussions of science and putting science up against religion and so on and so forth in recent years, and that is to sort of raise the suspicion that science might, that a sort of militantly scientific or scientistic worldview might eventually succumb to pressures which arise not from the outside but from within itself. That the scientific project, if pushed hard enough and if pushed in a sufficiently, as it were, fundamentalist spirit, might hit certain sorts of roadblocks that could be compellingly argued to be insurmountable. And thoughts like that, I think, have inspired a great deal from communities as diverse as, say, various kinds of post-structuralism in academia, or religious fundamentalism, or New Ageism, or something like that. And I just want to tell you a little today, for a few minutes, about what strikes me as the most interesting of those episodes to have come along in the history of fundamental physics. It's not one related to worries about reductionism, which is what Philip was bringing up. It's one related, as it were, to worries that come up in the opposite direction, in connection with the attempts of fundamental physics to tell itself stories about what it takes to be the most fundamental constituents of the world, and just how they behave, not how they come together to produce universities or love affairs or anything like that. So, you know, I'm referring to the history over the past 100 years of attitudes toward the foundations of quantum mechanics. 100 years ago, it's fair to say that physics aspired to produce a complete and unified and seamless and philosophically realistic and comprehensive account of all of nature. It aspired to tell us straightforwardly and authoritatively what the world is. It aspired to be the sort of picture of the world from which you could read off a metaphysics, and the only picture of the world from which you had any legitimate right to read off a metaphysics. And the deepest and the most interesting and the most universal and the most incessant motif of the physics of the century just past, the 20th century, was, as a matter of fact, the thought that all of this, that this kind of ambition had suddenly and decisively come to an end. It was thought for the better part of 100 years by all save one, of the greatest physicists in the world, the one exception to this was Einstein, that empirical investigations of the physical behaviors of subatomic particles had somehow made it clear that accounts like that, that accounts of that at that level of ambition, that accounts at that level of megalomania, were not going to be possible. It was thought that empirical investigations of the behaviors of subatomic particles had somehow brought us face to face for the first time in human history with the outermost limits of what could even in principle be scientifically inquired into. It was thought that the scientific project, as traditionally conceived, no longer made sense, that it was henceforth going to have to aim much lower, that it was going to have to content itself with a very sort of instrumental notion of predicting how experiments come out, that it was going to have to content itself with predicting the positions of pointers on measuring devices, and that it was going to have to abandon any hope of telling us straightforwardly how it is that those pointers get pushed in to those particular positions by the world. And I want to tell you a little bit about how it is that such things came to be believed. So consider how it is that I know that there's a table over there. Well, the scientific enterprise, and particularly the enterprise of physics as it's traditionally conceived, is very deeply committed to a certain particular story about how I know that. And the story runs crudely like this. There's electromagnetic radiation in the room, and some of that radiation reflects off the surface of the table, and some of that reflected light enters my eye and causes excitations, electrical excitations in my retina, and those excitations cause further excitations in my optic nerve, and those cause still further such excitations in my visual cortex, and eventually my brain gets into whatever particular physical state it is, or into one of whatever set of particular physical states it is, that corresponds to my being consciously aware that there's a table over there. And it is, of course, of the very essence of this story that all of this reflecting and transmitting and exciting takes place in strict accord with the fundamental laws of physics. It's of the very essence of this story, to put it slightly differently, that it treats the table and the room and the light and my eyes and my brain and everything it mentions as ordinary physical objects, the operations of which are subject in every detail to universal physical laws. And the very short way of saying it is that it happens that the business of telling stories like that radically comes apart in the context of quantum mechanics. That the business of telling stories like that about how I know the table is there radically comes apart in the context of this set of fundamental physical laws that was developed in response to our observations of the behaviors of subatomic particles. It happens that the fundamental laws of quantum mechanics simply do not allow for the telling of stories like that. And it was argued with quite astonishing energy and conviction and persistence by Niels Bohr and his circle in the 20s and 30s, that despite what you might think at first, this failure, this impossibility of telling these stories in the context of quantum mechanics, is emphatically not in the nature of an ordinary scientific problem. That more particularly, it's emphatically not to be understood as suggesting that there is anything wrong or incomplete or inadequate about quantum mechanics as the fundamental physical theory of the world. What they argued, on the contrary, was that what we were encountering here for the first time in human history is not at all in the nature of the limits of this or that particular scientific theory, but of the scientific enterprise itself. It's worth pausing to reflect on, for a second, to reflect on what a sort of astonishing intellectual development this is. We're familiar for hundreds of years in philosophy with philosophical sorts of arguments against realist attitudes toward the world. This is something quite new. There's a claim here that the outcomes of certain experiments that we performed on material objects, okay? There's a claim here that the outcomes of experiments we performed essentially on rocks somehow shows that that it's going to be impossible to construct a realistic account of the world. It's amazing that so many incredibly smart people could have been convinced of this on the basis of rather sketchy and flimsy arguments on Bohr's part. And that these convictions could have lasted so long, lasted something on the order of 70 years or so. And these are developments which had, I think, a rather profound effect on the culture and have been raised again and again in the context of attempts to produce, like I say, from various sectors of the culture, radical critiques of the scientific activity, from sectors that are superficially very diverse and would be shocked to hear that they have things in common with one another, but sectors like post-structuralism and religious fundamentalism and New Ageism and so on and so forth. Anyway, I don't have time to tell you any of the details of this story. I just want to report to you that the most significant upshot of investigations into the foundations of quantum mechanics over the past 20 years or so is that all this is wildly wrong. That the coming apart of these stories in the context of quantum mechanics is very much in the nature of an ordinary scientific problem, that it is very much to be understood as suggesting that there is something wrong or incomplete or inadequate about quantum mechanics as the fundamental physical theory of the world. And there are now a number of very ingenious and very promising traditionally scientific sorts of proposals on the table as to how quantum mechanics might be modified in such a way as to fix all this up. And a very curious, very extended, very widespread nightmare, I guess is the right word, that dominated much of the physics of the 20th century, notwithstanding the fantastic progress it made in all kinds of other senses, indeed the historically unprecedented progress it made in all kinds of other senses. This nightmare now seems to be lifting, and physics seems finally in a position to aspire again, at least to aspire again, to tell us how the world straightforwardly is. And let me just spend, is it okay for me to take one more minute? I don't know. Yeah? Okay. Good. The smoke is beginning to clear. It's going to take many, many years for it to clear more fully. But one can begin to think about how to say what kinds of lessons have been learned about the metaphysical structure of the world from the advent of quantum mechanics. And it's fair to say that no matter how things eventually pan out, the world is almost certainly we're going to be able to tell a story about the world. We're going to be able to tell a seamless, or at least the impression that there is something basic standing in the way of that, I think, is now lifting. But it also seems clear that the kind of story we're going to be able to tell about the world is almost certainly going to be very strange. It's not going to be incoherent. It's not going to be unintelligible. It's not going to be unrealist, but it's going to be very odd. And in particular, there are two rather fundamental convictions with which we've been making our way about in the world, more or less from the beginning of time, that almost certainly are going to turn out to be false. And let me just tell you very briefly about the two of those. One has to do with the following. there is a certain fantasy, or something that turns out to be a fantasy, there's a certain image, let's say, that has played a rather important structural role in the way we've thought about physics since its beginnings. And this image has to do with at least with the at least principled possibility of making observations in as close as we would like by taking a sufficient amount of trouble to a perfectly passive way, okay? Of having a kind of observational access to the world, if we're careful enough, in which we can be certain, or as certain as we like, or certain to any accuracy we please, of, as it were, not disturbing the system by observing it in such a way as to generate what we've observed, rather than being in a position to know that we're looking at something as it was before we looked. And there was much talk in science about the fact that some such idealized possibility was a necessary precondition of being able to do science with the world at all, okay? That things were somehow just going to get too confusing unless it was the case that we could set up conditions by taking a sufficient amount of trouble in which we knew we were looking at what was there before we looked, rather than something that was generated by a sort of uncontrollable interaction with, you know, with us in the act of looking at it, so on and so forth. It looks like this is false. It looks like one of the upshots of our investigations over the last century of the behaviors of subatomic particles is that observation is an absolutely unavoidably violent and disruptive process, that there are absolute limits to the extent to which that violence can be controlled. But it turns out, if you settle down and address the situation as it is, that this turns out, because it's controllable, it's not controllable to an arbitrary degree. There are absolute limits to the extent to which you're going to be able to control it. But the fact that you can control it at least some makes the fears that this would lead to a complete collapse of the whole scientific enterprise exaggerated. Okay, it turns out that we can figure out how to handle these situations. Another similar situation, a more shocking one. Here's another conviction with which we've made our way about in the world without ever seriously questioning forever. It's a conviction which is described in current scientific parlance as the conviction that the world is local. Okay. And what it means to assert of the world that it's local is to assert that that events over here directly and in an unmediated way only affect other events, only have causal effects on other events which are, as it were, spatially and temporally right in their neighborhoods, spatially and temporally contiguous with them. Okay, we often have the experience of, say, flipping a switch on the wall and seeing a light go on at some distance from where we are. But we're absolutely confident in cases like that that sufficiently careful investigations of what's going on in between the switch and the light, which we might undertake by, say, tearing up the wall and looking for wires and so on and so forth, are eventually going to put us in a position to tell a story of the form, well, the flipping of the switch produced certain electrical fields in its immediate vicinity, which caused certain motions of electrons in wires in its immediate vicinity, which then traveled a bit, knocked into electrons a little further down the wire, traveled a bit more, knocked into electrons still further down the wire, dot, 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 dot. And we're going to have a story of a whole chain, an unbroken spatiotemporally continuous chain of spatiotemporally contiguous mediating causes and effects, which stretches in an unbroken way from the light, from the switch to the light. And in general, we're confident that if something over here is the cause of something over here, a sufficiently close investigation of the intervening spatiotemporal region between this cause and its effect is going to reveal such a continuous chain of mediating causes and mediating effects and mediating causes and mediating effects. We have very, very powerful arguments now, arguments that go back to John Bell in the 1960s, that let me see how to put this in one concluding sentence. One of the things that was noticed about the theories that were developed in order to explain the observed behavior of subatomic particles was that they did not have this feature of locality, okay? That they appeared to involve direct and completely unmediated causal connections between events that were remote from one another spatially and temporally. The natural reaction to that is to say something like, we must not know everything yet. And indeed, this reaction was particularly natural in light of the fact that there had been an episode like this in physics before. This episode had to do with Newtonian gravitation. The way Newtonian gravitation was initially written down, it looked non-local again. It was referred to in the parlance of those times as action at a distance. Okay? And we had to wait a full 300 years or so in physics in order to have Newtonian gravitation replaced with a satisfactorily local account of gravitation that we got from Einstein, where we could see the effects propagating through something like a medium. The medium turned out to be space itself. Through something like a medium from here to here to here to here to here. But it's worth saying that as far back as Newton himself, everybody took it for granted for exactly this reason, that Newton's theory must not be the end of the story. Okay? That Newton's theory must be a pretty good phenomenological description of what's going on, but it can't be right, and Newton himself was confident of this, and precisely for the reason that it wasn't local. So it was a natural reaction to this feature of quantum mechanics to say, don't worry, don't get excited, we've been here before, I'm sure it's going to turn out okay. And the difference in the quantum mechanical case is that we have, unlike in the Newtonian case, a simple, straightforward, absolutely rigorous proof from John Bell, one of the most stunning scientific events of the 20th century, I think, that it is simply going to be a mathematical impossibility for any theory to reproduce the already experimentally confirmed observational predictions of quantum mechanics without having this feature of non-locality. So this is a talk whose moral is, again, don't bet too quickly against the Enlightenment. There was an interesting and peculiar sort of crisis in the aspirations that physics held for itself for most of the 20th century. That has now, I think it's fair to say, passed, but it leaves us with a description of the world which, although it's realistic, which although it promises to be a satisfactory way of reducing everything else to physics, which although it preserves all of the megalomaniacal aspirations that physics had as of 100 years ago, is nonetheless very, very strange. Thanks.
Thanks. Can I just ask one quick question of the two of you before we go, which is that this whole notion of the thing you raised there at the end about John Stuart Bell or about David Bohm's work and so on, you often find, certainly you dealt with those people in that movie, that there's a sort of a refuge, a sanctuary for some people who feel like they're on the run in the face of Darwinian certainties, and look for some sort of a sanctuary in physics, and find perhaps they'll find some sort of salvation, some workable God there. In the same way as that you could also make parallels with a sort of a Spinozistic universe there where there's connections. It gets a bit touchy-feely, a bit new-agey, but there's some people try and make a serious case about that.
Yes.
What's your comment on that?
Well, just that. I mean, I think that basically the influence of Bohr and his circle throughout most of the 20th century very much opened the way for developments of the kind that you described. Serious physicists always professed to be appalled at such use being made of their work and so on and so forth. But as far as I can tell, the only legitimate objection they would have to that is that it wasn't expressed in sufficiently high-class language. Bohr was certainly committed to a claim that the aspiration of science to produce a comprehensive and seamless and realistic account of what the world was something that he and his circle had discovered was impossible. Okay, that is that the aspiration of science to take over the job of metaphysics. Okay, was something that he and his circle had discovered was impossible, and that this was a moment which was going to change the history of science permanently and irrevocably, and it was going to change it by way of reducing the highest ambitions to which it was entitled. Okay, if these people then were appalled that people started writing books like The Tao of Physics or making movies like What the Bleep, like I say, that strikes me as more of a class distinction than an intellectual one. They were very much opening themselves to that. The arguments for that were weak. The ways of intellectually enforcing it were shamefully dogmatic. And it turned out to be wrong.
Sean, do you have a comment? And also, Rebecca, I think you had a hand up.
Okay, yeah, I actually have nothing to say about what you just asked, but I remembered one thing that I wanted to say in response to Stuart's talk, which is I think that despite the fact that the strong reductionist claim is an incredibly strong claim, that the way that Stuart phrased it was too strong, which is that there exists a microscopic description of the entire world that is sort of foundational and reductionistic, and there is no room for anything else. And I wouldn't state it that way. I would say, and there is no need for anything else. And the example that I would give is if I have a glass of water, in response to the idea, where in biology or where in cell biology do you find the function of the human heart? And I would say, let's take, you have a glass of water, there's nothing biological or transcendental about it, and I describe that glass of water by giving you a long list of 10 to the 28 numbers, which are the position and momenta of every single water molecule in the glass. I think that no one thinks that in principle I couldn't tell you everything there is to tell you about the glass of water from that list and from the laws of physics, but if I point at the list and say, where does it say that the water is wet, it's really hard to extract that. And this is the distinction I was trying to draw between really hard and impossible. I think that it's still okay to say, even if I believe in chemistry, that the water is wet, even though it's not there in the chemical description. You're allowed to add these extra layers on. The reductionistic claim is just that you don't need to. You could describe the world perfectly well if you chose without using those words.
I'm trying to figure out if I agree with what you just said. I'm not sure if I do or not. I can imagine two ways of fleshing out the claim that there is no room for anything else.
It depends on the word room.
Right. I mean, one way is to interpret it methodologically, okay? And there, it shouldn't be controversial. And if that's all you mean, I agree with you. That is, it's not going to be a consequence of any kind of reductionist stance that the best way to pursue psychoanalysis is by starting with the Schrodinger equation and solving it. That's not a good idea.
Okay.
That's not going to work. And we invent all kinds of special sciences and special science vocabularies to paper over a whole bunch of details about stuff that we don't know and that are going to turn out not to be relevant to the particular problem we're interested in solving. That's absolutely right. If, on the other hand, as people sometimes, there are a lot of people who are anti-reductionist who want to say something like, I've got no objection to the laws of physics. All of this occurs in accord with the laws of physics. But talk as if those laws still leave them some kind of wiggle room, or this is just something on top of them, or something like that. And if that's the impression, I think it's important to repeat that all of the laws of physics with which we've had any familiarity, all the proposals for fundamental laws of physics, by which I mean Newtonian laws together with a statistical mechanical structure where you have a probability distribution over initial conditions, or the Schrodinger equation, or anything, it's a feature of these things that there is no formulable proposition about the physical history of the world on which they turn out to be agnostic. Okay, there isn't any question which they refrain from answering. Okay, if you have infinite calculational ability, and if you ask if you're given a probability distribution over initial positions and velocities, and you're given the Newtonian equations of motion, and then you ask a supercomputer to calculate from there the probability that Mary Tyler Moore was the Zodiac killer. You're going to get an answer, okay? There isn't anything on which they're agnostic. There isn't anything on which they refrain from making a pronouncement. And in that sense, there isn't any room.
Yeah, now that's what I meant by saying they're complete. I don't think we disagree about anything.
Okay,
all right.
Okay.
So I think on that note, unfortunately, we have to stop. And thank you both.